Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. That is the piano genius of Bob Mamet, one of four guests who will be here this entire first hour, because we have reached a interesting mark in the road of the adventure that is the resurrection of Mr. Kelly's David Marienthal, my old friend from high school, actually, 5 years ago, sat down with me at Ricardo's and said, hey, I'm thinking of, like, doing something. He didn't say it like this. We weren't loaded. I'm thinking about resurrecting what was my uncle and father's nightclubs, those nightclubs being Mr. Kelly's, the Happy Medium, and the London House. David, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rick. You know, I think part of this whole journey that's been...
Don't blame me for this. Don't blame me for this.
The most fun about it is getting to be reacquainted with you after high school.
It has been. No, it has been fun. And
you've been so great. And
well, I've been fascinated with...
Such an inspiration.
I'm fascinated with the journey, as I'm sure Bob Mamet is, who's sitting to your right, and Denise Tomasello, one of the legendary... Is songbird a bad word? Is that a sexist word?
I don't think so.
I love the phrase, but
then
if it's sexist, I'll try to stop saying it. And the newest member of the Mr. Kelly's Adventure, Kay Winks, who is an ensemble member of Second City? What do you call it?
I am. I'm an ensemble member of She the People.
Okay. David, there is a big event on Sunday the 24th. It is sold out for the meal portion of it, but it is really... To my mind, the final part of the resurrection of Mr. Kelly, because it's taking place on the very ground, the hallowed ground where Mr. Kelly sat, which is now Gibson Steakhouse. How did this come to be, David? You've been working on a documentary.
I've been working on the documentary now for 5 years, and we have over 100 interviews, including like celebrities. We just got back from interviewing Lily Tomlin, the Smothers Brothers, Bob Newhart, Jackie Green, Lainey Kazan, and as well as so many local people that have just been so much generous.
The one thing about it, and you can all get in this. Kay, you're vastly younger than any of us in the room, except maybe Bob. but the thing that has always amazed me about it is the affection that people feel for Mr. Kelly's. Mr. Kelly's closed in like 1975, sort of, five-ish.
It's amazing the people that are just coming out of the woodwork, that loved Kelly's, that met their husband there, that saw Barbara Streisand, you know, when she first came onto the scene, that discovered Richard Pryor on their prom night, if you can imagine. That knew my father and uncle.
What'd you do for your prom? Well, I saw this very interesting African-American comic. Where did Billy take you? He took you where? Bob, you and Denise have a real, I've known you both for a very long time, a real affinity for and affection for the era that is evoked by the resurrection of Mr. Kelly's. I mean, the CD we were just playing is titled London House.
That's right. So many great pianists came out of the London House, and then of course also, you know, Mr. Kelly's. These guys, Oscar Peterson, Bill Evans, you know, and then our own Ramsey Lewis, you know, Chicago's own Ramsey Lewis. So, I mean, these weren't just jazz greats of the era. They're jazz greats of all time.
Well, the acts that performed at Kelly's and the London House, not so much the Happy Medium, defined a couple decades of entertainment in the United States.
Well, they really introduced all the stars of the 20th century. And right at the corner of where Gibson's is now. And I do want to make sure and remember to thank Steve Lombardo and Gibson's.
Well, Steve Lombardo
for sponsoring this dinner show that we're going to do, which is going to include portions from the original Mr. Kelly's menu. It's going to include the Green Goddess salad, the Candy Crunch cake, and then, as in the day, a full entertainment package where you're going to be able to sit in this intimate setting and enjoy the best of Chicago talent.
Denise, so, you also have an affinity and affection for that era as Chicago's leading cabaret singer.
Thank you.
Really do. I mean, that's your act has always evoked that
period. I never, ever wanted to do anything but be a nightclub singer. And I never wanted to be a pop singer. When I was young, this is what I loved. When I really didn't go to nightclubs because I was too young, but I would see it on television, and I instantly fell in love with it. I was like, that's what I want to do.
So, comics being a intrinsic thread in the history and success of Kelly's, you decided to go find a comic, and you found this young, so far very nice. We've had a lovely
Thank
conversation.
You. Thank
You're
you.
Very welcome. What did you know, Kay Winks, mm-hmm. about Mr. Kelly's before David Marienthal tackled you outside of Second City and said, you got to help me?
I had never heard of Mr. Kelly's.
Okay.
I had heard of Gibson's, however.
Okay.
So when he tied those together, I was like, oh, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. But then I started hearing the names. Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin, Joan Rivers, who's my favorite. She's my inspiration for getting into comedy.
Is she?
Absolutely. She's my favorite comedian ever.
Do you watch Mrs. Maisel?
Yes, of course I do. It's my favorite show.
Who do you think? Okay, the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. You think it's absolutely based on Joan Rivers?
I totally do.
Okay.
Yes. Well, at least the performance. I don't know if the actual bio of her.
Right.
Is,
right.
For sure, the performance.
So, what did David say? How did David? How did you find Kay? And how did you approach her?
Our director for the documentary, Teddy Bogosian, was in town looking at the post-production of the film and planning the show, and he had had a contact with Second City, so we went in and saw Kay at the Black History Month show, and we were just knew right away that we were again in the presence of future greatness, and we wanted to get her on the way up, the same way that you know, the Kellys did have.
Well, I want to talk. You guys are going to be on for the entire hour, but one of the other hallmarks of George and Oscar Marienthal was their kind of absolute, in an era where being colorblind in the entertainment business was not the norm. They really did. They booked anybody, regardless of skin color. True?
They booked anybody.
And hired a lot of people.
And they treated their staff. Some of the first to introduce profit-sharing plans, totally multiracial staff, welcomed clientele when, you know, and defended clientele when Ernie Banks would walk into the London House and maybe a white client next to him would move away.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? And, when I was a young reporter, there was a place called Ricardo's over at Rush and Hubbard, and I would go out there Friday nights drinking to excess, as we did in the newspaper business in those days. And my parents, they'd retired, were a little worried about me and said, well, how is everything at Ricardo's? And I go, well, they had been longtime aficionados of the place. And I said, well, it's fine, Dad, but explain to me why at 5:30 on Friday I'll see elderly black couples coming in to have dinner, and it just doesn't seem like, why would they be doing this? Why would they be going there? It's buried under, you know, lower Russian Hubbard. And my father explained to me that Rick Ricardo, too, was one of the few, along with George and Oscar Marienthal, restaurateurs downtown who welcomed African Americans in the post-World War II years. That freaked me out. I said, this is not Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. That was a real, real revelation to me. We got to take a break. We'll be back to talk more about this event on March 24th, which is sort of, you could call it The Legend Comes Alive. You could call it The Legend Comes Back to Life. It's going to feature the comedy of Kay Winks, the singing of Denise Tomasello, the musical genius of Bob Mamet, and the entrepreneurial skill of David Marienthal.
Great food of Gibson's.
Huh? Oh, yeah, Gibson's. Oh, yeah, Gibson's. Only the sixth most successful restaurant in the United States of America. Gibson's flabbergasted me. Steve Lombardo and his wonderful family, including his daughter Liz, they know how to run a restaurant. The great Dan Long is engineering this show, so it will not be better than what Ernie Scanton does, but it will be that distinctive Dan Long production skills. Get Real in the Morning with Larry Potash, Ramin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, and the entire WGN TV morning news team, weekdays 4 to 10 in the morning. On March 24th, 2 weeks from today, from 5:30 to 9:30, there's going to be an extravaganza upstairs at Gibson's Steakhouse at the corner of Rush and Bellevue, which was once the site of Mr. Kelly's. It is all the work of, though he doesn't perform, David Marienthal, the son and nephew of the two men, George and Oscar Marienthal, who ran Kelly's and Jesh and the Happy Medium and the London House, which was right at the corner of Michigan and Wacker, but he has gathered talents in this room. When you decided to do this, you decided, obviously, that you wanted someone playing a musical instrument. You wanted someone singing, because such people as Sarah Vaughan have recorded live at Mr. Kelly's. And you wanted someone telling jokes, because people like Richard Pryor and George Carlin and, oh man, everybody was there. How did you decide put together this show?
When I thought of the venue, I thought of, well, you could go into Mr. Kelly's and see Nancy Wilson and Woody Allen for the price of a $2.50 drink. And so I knew I had to have somebody funny and somebody that sang beautifully. So I certainly, and then they also had an unbelievable jazz combo, Larry Novak,
Johnny Frigo,
Dick Reynolds, and these were guys that were so talented that the acts continually enticed them to travel with them.
Sure.
But they were based in Chicago. And so Bob Mamet and I...
Let me ask you how you knew Bob.
Bob Mamet and I started on this project again a few years ago, where he cut an album called London House Blues,
which we're hearing,
which caught my attention because it was his reminiscence and his homage.
Your
to
first
London
instinct
House.
Wasn't to sue him, right? And,
no, it was not. It was to appreciate it and talk about how we could work together. So
That's
we've been
great.
Talking about working together.
That's right.
For a few years, and I was so honored to have him come on board, and then Denise. I had met many times in the cabaret, and you know, when I thought of, we did a couple of shows where we reenacted Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald's albums that they cut at, Daryl Nitz. But when I thought of a cabaret singer, they could really, you know, harken back to Barbra Streisand, Bette Midler, I thought of Denise, and she came very highly recommended.
and then
you're being
thinking,
a generous person, as well as a star performer.
So with Kay, you heard about her. You said this: the documentary's producer came in, and you decided to go to Second City, and there she was.
That was it. We saw her, and we just she cracked us up, and so that to me, I think comics are pretty straightforward about how to evaluate a comic if they're making you laugh. And,
it's interesting, Kay. The work done at Second City is hardly what anyone would characterize as stand-up. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It really isn't. That's just down the street at Zany's. Mm-hmm. So what do you think it was? I'm going to ask you. He obviously thinks you're a grand talent.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it was about, and what kind of act are you going to do at this The Legend Comes Alive show 2 weeks from tonight?
So what I think it was probably just my natural charm, and quirkiness, and, I'm funny. But what I plan to do is I do character work. I am probably going to tell stories. It will be stand-up, but my stand-up style is more along the lines of, is Lily Tomlin-esque, where
sure.
You don't really do, joke. Punchline.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to do, be the female Henny Youngman, for God's sake.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But no, storytelling,
is
a matter of kind of stand-up, too. Are you excited about this? You
absolutely.
Must be. Have you ever heard Denise sing?
I've heard her online.
Okay. What about Bob? You're hearing him tonight play.
Bob, I saw a YouTube video that
I did,
dug up, It was amazing. Loved it.
I want to thank David, because he is making this dream come true for me. Because I would have loved to play Mr. Kelly. So this is an actual dream of mine, and you're making it come true.
David, let me ask you something. I know you're doing this a documentary, and there's some notion of either a feature film or maybe a TV series of sorts. Have you ever, you told me that, and we're roughly the same age, that when your uncle and dad were running Kelly's, you were more likely to be at the Kinetic Playground, seeing The Who or something. It wasn't your real scene. Have you gotten at all any sort of urge to run a nightclub?
I was in the restaurant business for a couple of decades here in Chicago, so I definitely had it in the blood. But as you say, when my father had the clubs and I was a teenager in my very early 20s, I was a rebel type.
Yeah.
And so my father and I, being an old school businessman, did not always see eye to eye And I did get the opportunity to do the lights and the sound at Mr. Kelly's for a summer for Sarah Vaughan, and it was an amazing, amazing experience.
Well, but, why do you think, not to go over old ground with you, but why do you think at the time you and your brother were not, did not say, it's one thing to like a different kind of music, but those were on any level the hippest clubs in Chicago at the time. No question about it.
Well, I think it's like, you know, it's like, if you have a teenage son, you know that no matter how hip you are, how cool you are, you're not cool in his eyes. And, you know, I could not see that. And
yeah,
my father was booking these people. And, you know, they booked Lenny Bruce.
Sure.
And we're lucky enough to have Kitty Bruce, Lenny's daughter, is coming to the show. She's flying in. And she is very excited. And she's
a character and a half.
And,
boys
and she's
and girls.
Bringing a check. A bill that Lenny signed at Kelly's, his bar tab, the original bar tab that from Lenny Bruce.
That's fantastic.
And so, you know, we're getting some real people that are real fans coming
Bob,
in.
For you, you know, as a real Chicagoan with deep, deep roots here, this has got to be, especially because of the whole London House homage that
yes.
you did. This has got to be very meaningful for you. What kind of set are you going to do? Is it going to be an homage to some of the greats there?
Yes. In fact, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we're going to do an Oscar Peterson a set piece called Reunion Blues, as well as a Bill Evans. And also, we're going to do a Dave Brubeck tribute
Great. That
includes a little story behind it and his first composition and the composition of his boisterous sax player, Paul Desmond, Take Five.
Wow.
So we're going to be running the gamut there. And then I'm going to end the set with my own composition, which is a tribute to Ramsey Lewis. So it's like we're going to mix it up a little. Yeah.
Denise, what about you? What are you going to sing?
Well, it's going to be a little bit of Barbara, a little bit of Bette, a little bit of Ella, and a little bit of me.
Wow. And you've got your songs picked,
yeah,
do you?
Pretty much.
And you're not doing a rehearsal till day of?
I'm rehearsing with my trio a couple days before.
Well, we're doing a dress rehearsal. And the whole event is going to be filmed, professionally style filmed concert video, because this is going to be part of the documentary film. This is, in fact, kind of the culmination of the story of the film of recreating the legacy of Mr. Kelly. So along with the great history, the great interviews, the great photos we have, we're going to show with this great talent how, you know, this legacy still lives on in the film. So everybody that walks in...
We'll
it's going
to
be part
a waiver.
Of the,
yeah, sure.
Part of the film.
Kay Wings, that put any extra pressure on you?
No, I'm ready.
Denise?
I'm ready.
Bob?
It's going to be fun, Rick. It's going to be a ball.
You didn't ask me, Rick. I feel quite
bad. You. No, you're always at loose ends. You got to put the thing together.
I'm not an experienced MC like you are.
No, you're the impresario, and impresarios are always nervous until everything's done. We got to take a break, then get some news, and then I'm going to talk to these three entertainers about their careers in history, because I am ever. I know a little about Bob's and I know a little about Denise's, but you listeners don't know much, and I don't know anything about Kay's, but I am ever curious what draws people to art, music, comedy, because there's never any money in art, music, comedy. I mean, it really is the draw is passion. And I'm always interested in that. So we listen to some commercials. I'll tell you that coming up are the stories that matter with Roger Badish, who came in here just a few minutes ago to tell us that he went to Mr. Kelly. I can't remember. Who did he see? He saw Ramsey Lewis. So he was in the front row. That's what he said.
Yeah.
From the Northwest Medicine Newsroom on WGN. We'll be right back. Bob Mamet on piano. Piano from a CD of about how many years ago, Bob? And why did you name it in honor of the London House?
Well, you know, there was just so much history. What I discovered was, like Mr. Kelly had discovered so many, you know, great singers and comedians, the London House had discovered really and had cultivated the careers of the greatest jazz pianists. You know, who would become the greatest jazz pianists of all time. So that intrigued me.
What drew you to music, Bob Mamet, when you were a little boy?
Well, you know, it's a lot of things, I guess. A lot of things. My father played the piano. He was an attorney by trade, but he played. My brother David played. And I would... my room in the house was adjacent to our living room. And they both had... My brother and father had insomnia, and they would get up at all hours of the night
and play the piano.
And I would just kind of sit there and take it in, you know, because no kid wants to go to bed, right?
Right.
And I would just sit and take it in all night. So that was like
it's like career by osmosis.
Exactly.
When did you get serious about it?
Well, probably when I went to the Peabody Conservatory, and then I went. I went west to L.A. and I started playing in the recording studios as a studio musician and composer.
Yeah, you've had a good career. I mean, you left Chicago for a while to go play studio stuff, which is can be a very good career in Los Angeles.
Yes, that was good.
And then came back. How have you found it since you've come back?
I love Chicago. I mean, I think Chicago's from a cultural standpoint, from a musical standpoint, it's one of the most vibrant cities in the world, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the recording business? The recording business has been thrown into chaos in the last 10 or 15 years.
It's true. It's not exactly what it used to be. But one positive takeaway, it's changed a lot, but one positive takeaway is we have a lot more freedom now as to what, you know, there's not a lot of people telling us what to do anymore.
Well, or
right?
How to record it.
And you can get your music to the people, directly to the people, as opposed to all the channels we used to have to jump through. Yeah.
Denise Tomasello, you said to us that you wanted to be a nightclub singer since you were a child. How does that happen to a child of the suburbs? How does that happen? What did you see?
Oh, I was walking around the house smoking a cigarette. No, I'm kidding.
And having a martini.
Having a martini.
Yes. My parents drank martinis and smoked all the time, so I said, well, I better stay in this kind of environment.
No, I would watch old movie musicals, and Judy Garland was... You know, to me, she was everything, and I just wanted to be Judy Garland. And then I would watch the movies that had the nightclub singer walk out in the dress and the orchestra behind her, and she'd sing a few songs. And I said, oh, wow, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And I was kind of the family entertainer of the house, so I was always funny and mimicking people and singing, and I just... told everyone, I said, well, when I grow up, I'm going to be in show business.
You kind of had a charmed career. I mean, you started off working.
I did. Yeah. I was really, really lucky. I got into a little lounge group in the suburbs, and an agent walked in, and he booked the top of the towers at the Arlington Park Hilton.
Sure.
Do you remember that? That had legendary acts from around the country. And an agent came downstairs, and I was singing in a little room called the Tack Room. And I had put together a trio and said, I'm not going to do this anymore because they want to dance. I want to sing somewhere where people are paying attention and listening to me.
How old were you?
I was about early 20s. And so,
bold.
I know. Bold. And so I said, now I'm going to retire. I'm just going to do this for a month because I'm going to sing all the songs I want to sing. And this agent came up to me and he said, what are you doing out here? And I said, oh, it's only 15 minutes from my house.
Yes, I want a convenient career.
And he said, you don't belong here because I know the perfect place for you downtown. And I said, really? And he said, yes. He says, I'm going to come in here tomorrow night and I'm going to bring the entertainment director. She used to work for me. The next night, he didn't show up. So I thought, oh, this is just some guy trying to hit on me. Monday morning, I got a phone call from Sages.
Oh, Jesus.
And they said, we want you to come in and audition. I came in, and they said, bring three songs. I had to sit in cold, and the agent, she was the entertainment director, she said, I heard so much about you from Chuck Eddy. I said to myself, who's Chuck Eddy?
That's how all entertainment directors talk.
And I said, who's Chuck Eddy? And then I realized, I said, oh, my God, that's the man that came up to me on my job over the weekend.
And you were permanent at Sage's.
She said, I'll give you a two-week booking.
Yeah.
And it lasted for 6 years, five nights a week.
That's a great story.
And I launched my whole career in the Gold Coast.
Yeah, it's a great story. Now, young Kay Winks.
Yes.
What drew you to comedy? Please don't tell me you were the class clown or something.
No, that's not that. gosh, I've been drawn to comedy for a long time, but how I got into it originally was that I met one of the producers of Comic Relief on HBO, Jacques Fiorentino, when I was living in L.A., years ago, and I was working at a restaurant, really nice restaurant, and a lot of big A-list celebrities would come in, and I would just relate to my tables by cracking jokes. And then the HBO guy came in, and he's like, you're actually genuinely funny, you should think about doing comedy. And I was like, well, no, I'm an actress, you know, I'm an aspiring starlet out here in L.A. And he's like, yeah, everybody does that. Like, who cares?
Sure,
but you're actually
sure.
funny. You're a funny girl, you know, because girls.
Did you realize that about yourself?
You know, I knew that I was humorous, but I didn't take it seriously as a career.
As a career path, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it as like, I'll be a comic actress. I'll book a pilot on a network.
Sure, sitcom.
Sitcom, exactly.
Sure, sure.
But from that inspiration, he became my comedy writing mentor. And so I wrote a solo show called Token, which was about my experiences being the only black girl around all white people, because I am from Naperville.
Yeah.
And I debuted Token in Chicago. I moved back to Chicago from L.A. Debuted Token here.
Where?
And the very first performance was at Collaboration over in Wicker Park.
Sure, sure.
And then from there, I took it to Second City, to Second City's Training Center. And I sold out all my shows. And
what year was this?
This was in 2017.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then did they ask you to become a member of Second City?
That's how I became employed with Second City, was that I invited all the producers from Second City to come see the show, and they liked it. And then I auditioned for She the People, and I've been an ensemble member of She the People now since April of last year.
Congratulations. That, Bob is nodding, Denise is nodding. That is a great career path. How old are you?
A woman never tells.
That's good. That's good. Are you still writing? Do you do a lot of your own, writing your own? You still write a lot of your own material?
Yes, I write a lot of my own material. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The goal is to make my own content for myself. Yeah.
And the goal beyond, you know, the Second City goals have been, I mean, there is a certain career path that exists at Second City.
Yes.
There was a piece in the Tribune today by Ron Grossman about the early days of Second City, and in the mid-70s, Bernie Solins, who was one who ran Second City for a while, he used to tell the producers of Saturday Night Live, which started in 78, to stay away. They did not stay away and did that. But your goal? I mean, you obviously you can learn a great deal being at Second City. There's no question about it.
I've learned so much at Second City. Yeah. I'm very thankful to Second City. And yes, Second City definitely has the SNL pipeline.
Sure.
But my goal would be to be Lorne Michaels and not be on SNL.
Fantastic. Fantastic. When you hear this, David, from young performers, and I'm calling all three of you young because you're younger than David and I are, this must warm your heart. I mean, because your dad and uncle heard these kind of stories from people like, you know, from Bette Midler, from Bob Newhart, from these people.
Yeah, we've talked extensively with Arlene Rothberg, who is their talent booker.
Sure.
And so she talks about going to the bitter end for a couple of weeks, and she hired Smothers Brothers, Streisand, Woody Allen, all with a handshake. These were...
Yeah,
starving artists ready to, you know, would, you know, and when and everybody we talked to, Kelly's was the cream to the cream.
Yeah. Sure, you know, question.
When they hit Kelly's, they'd been playing. I mean, even the Bitter End, as famous as it was a coffee shop.
Yeah,
and you know, playing in the Tom Dreesen was playing all over the Midwest, and then when him and Tim Reed came and got to Mr. Kelly's, you know, they knew they had arrived.
Second City has a kind of marquee on North Avenue, you know, with but it has too many names on it for my taste. But the marquee at Mr. Kelly's had to be it. I mean, it was like having a marquee in Vegas.
Right.
And then when it did burn down in 1966, the whole block burned down all the way from Oak Street to to Bellevue, and you know there was the whole city mourned. You know, the Rush Street Dead. You know, after that, but then they did. You know,
well, Rush Street kind of died after Kelly's closed. After Kelly closed, they
rebuilt it. And
very fallow years
we're
there.
So happy to be bringing it back.
And now it's at Gibson's. We will spend the last 15 minutes or so of this hour talking about the event at Gibson's. Thanks for sharing that stuff about your careers. You, I knew about, but I'd forgotten the Arlington Park portion of it. We'll be back in, I don't know. Genius, Bob Mamet. Bob Mamet will be one of the three performers. Are you going to be with your trio, or is it just you?
Yes, I'm playing with Denise's trio, which I'm excited.
Well,
for the first time.
Well,
it's going to be fun.
And my new good friend, Kay Winks, does not have a trio.
Otherwise, I wish I could. I do sing as well.
Okay. These are the three performers who will be at The Legend Comes Alive, the sort of revival of the glory days at the corner of Rush and Bellevue that was Mr. Kelly's. It's now Gibson's Steakhouse. On the 24th, from 5:30 to 9:30, there will be food that was served at Mr. Kelly's. There will be an homage to that remarkable place. It is sold out, but, David Marienthal,
well, we had
for
the
listeners
the fortunate problem for us and unfortunate for all the clamoring fans that wanted to get tickets, but we put the tickets on sale on the internet, and they sold out in 10 days.
Well, that's why Gibson's is the sixth most lucrative
seats
restaurant
with
in the country.
A dinner package and a VIP package, and they all,
but there is
they all
the
sold
chance.
Out. And but we do have one option for people that want to come and join the excitement, and that is the bar adjacent to the room upstairs is a very comfortable room where we're going to be serving drinks at a cash bar, and we're going to be having the concert on closed circuit TV, and the music will be in there, and so it'll be a nice way to share the excitement. There's no charge, so we hope people will stop
show
by if they're in the neighborhood to see Gibson's. And also, you know, look at our website at www.mrkellyschicago.com and make sure you sign up for our mailing list, because we will be doing another event like this, obviously, even more so now that we know how it sold out. And
speak, Denise. What do you want to say?
I wanted
you
to mention,
talk all
I wanted to mention that the two musicians that are going to be playing with Bob are Jim Cox on bass and Todd Howell.
Another guy I've known for 40 years.
And Todd Howell on drums. And my musical director is going to be Nick Sula. So I just wanted to give them so that you understand.
Very talented cats.
You guys really are. I can see it here. It's palpable, your excitement at this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You, of course, David, but the three of you
I'm super excited.
Being part of this in UK is not knowing any
well,
of these people.
We were just
before.
Saying that the reason it sold out is certainly the Mr. Kelly's followers that we have, and we do have 9,000 friends on Facebook, and it's a very exciting Facebook page if you're Mr. Kelly's Chicago. But Denise and Bob and Kay, they're fans. Like, we're all over these tickets. And they have a very loyal
You might
fan
think,
base.
I mean, I'm not putting the words in the mouth or Steve Lombardo, who runs extraordinarily well Gibson's and a number of other restaurants, but this is likely to be the first, I would have to think, of a number of Welcome Back Mr. Kelly shows.
Well, as you've been talking about, of course, London House, their other steakhouse with Jazz Club up where is now the home of London House Hotel.
Right.
And we're proud to also have the Oxford Group and London House Hotel being a sponsor of this event. And so we hope to collaborate with them in the future as well.
What's where the happy medium was? There's nothing.
The happy medium is now the Tesla dealership.
That's right. So, drive the cars out and just
not for long. Tesla's closing down their dealership. So
that's right.
Oh,
wow. Move happy medium maybe.
The happy medium return.
Perfect.
Tesla's gone, and the happy medium comes back. David, you must be. I know you're a relatively laid back guy, but you must be very proud of yourself being able to pull this together, and especially because you three performers and the other people you mentioned, Denise Tomasello, is likely to be the culminating shots of this long in the works documentary.
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm very proud and very excited how this thing has just continued to gather steam. I mean, we just, you know, every day we find something new. We had George Carlin's daughter sent us a cassette recently of Carlin's personal notes tape that he made at Kelly's.
Wow.
That, wow. You know, that he used.
And you still have that nice kid, Adam, working for you?
We have Adam. We have a great...
greatest, our youngest and greatest
researcher, a graduate of Loyola University that just is the encyclopedia of Mr. Kelly's London house. We have our film director, Ted Bogosian, on board now. We have Scott Dumler, our editor, who does a lot of work with Rick Bayless.
What is your... what do you anticipate for this documentary once it's finished?
Well, we're looking to have a 50-minute, an hour-long documentary made by this summer, and we hope to have it on PBS within the year.
And PBS National?
Yeah, and as well as, you know, introducing into film festivals. So we really, you know, think it's something that Chicago should be so proud of. You know, for me, you know, I never knew, again, that it was, you know, even, you know, when I started this 5 years ago, I never realized. My mother was very humble about it. My father, you know, passed away 50 years ago. And so I didn't know what a national treasure this was. And I didn't know what, you know, Chicago was at that point in terms of being the center and the birth of entertainment and being just such, you know, so it's just, you know, it's something that needs to be told about.
And
Chicago.
You, Bob Mamet, and you, Denise Tomasello, certainly over the years in the business have heard a great deal about Mr. Kelly's, and so this event will probably reaffirm a lot of things for you, Kay Winks. This is going to be a real revelation, I think.
Absolutely. As my parents were telling me about when I told them about Mr. Kelly's, they said that they dated when they first met. It was right around that Rush area. So they knew of...
Your parents were wild. What was wrong with your
parents? But they're excited because this is their old... this is
stomping
reminding
grounds.
Them of, exactly. And the longer I live here, as a suburban girl, like, this is amazing. Every day I learn something new about the, like, majesty of Chicago history.
Yeah.
So that's what's really exciting about it. And I'm really thankful that I have been invited to be a part of it.
That's great.
Yeah.
When the invitation came, was it right after you had seen Kay? You said, was it after?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I think it was within a couple of weeks. We were well. In fact, we put out our first notice that we said we had Denise and Bob, and then we put out soon to be announced rising comedy prodigy. And actually, that was before we had met.
That's,
before we
that's
had
a
met
heavy birdie there, lady. Rising comedy prodigy. Whoa. So it is sold out for the food portion of it, but there is a lot of room upstairs at Gibson's where you can go on the night of March 24th. Everything begins at 5:30 and 9:30. I'd get there around 5 if I were you. We'd go upstairs and have...
And if we do have other seats open up, again, if you could go to our website.
Yeah, the website is very cool. You should
MrKellyChicago.com.
Whether you're listening in Anchorage, Alaska, or, you know, Queens, New York, go to the website, MrKellyChicagoNoApostrophe.com. And that'll lead you to the Facebook page and a lot of other things, because it really is fascinating, David.
We have all our great photos. We just
and you have a portion of the documentary, right?
And
a little
we have
taste
our,
of
our latest interviews with Lily Tomlin and Woody Allen. And
how were they to, you know, those are... I've interviewed them both.
Lily was just very generous, very warm, great story. She was at Kelly's during a tumultuous time of a woman's protest, so she had a lot of good stories about that. Woody is kind of shy, but he really, you know, had a lot of respect for my father and uncle and his manager that got him in there.
What was the most revelatory interview for you?
I think one of the most revelatory interviews was Dick Gregory, when we were talking to Dick Gregory.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, both, you know, privately, he was certainly, you know, respectful of my father and my uncle, the way he talked to the employees, but he was also very realistic about what it was like to be a black performer on Rush Street during those times.
His first gig was at the Playboy Club when, you know who canceled? Professor Irwin Corey. Do you remember that? You don't, Kay. That weird, I always thought he was a very bizarre kind of comic. But he canceled, thereby allowing Dick Gregory to become the first black performer at the Playboy Clubs, which is something. And then he went to Kelly's, because Kelly's was marvelously, wonderfully colorblind. Bob Mamet, it's always great to see you. Give your mother, Judy, a big hug for me.
Yes, and
Denise Tomasello, I'll hug you when this is over. Kay Winks, it's a pleasure to meet you.
You too.
I'm not going to call you a prodigy, but I find I look forward to seeing you perform.
Thank you.
You're a charismatic young woman. David Marienthal, you're an impresario of the most energetic sort, and you keep pulling this off. I don't know how many times you've been on this show, but you're always great on this show.
To get some of yours.
And
Thank you so much, Rick.
No, it's my pleasure. And there's always something kind of to celebrate with Kelly. You can't wait for the movie to come out. Can't wait for the movie to come out. Get all of you three will be in it.
That's right.
And maybe that will be sold out, too. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you. I'm extremely honored.
Welcome back. That is still the piano playing of the incredibly talented Bob Mamet, who happens to be, and we didn't talk much about it when he was on the last hour, the younger brother of a certain famous Chicago playwright named David Mamet. It is a great pleasure for me to have on the telephone Sanford Horwitt. You may not know that name, but if you buy his book, Conversations with Abner Mikva, you will be inspired. You will kind of be, I think, disgusted with the current state of American politics, because Abner Mikva was a giant of American politics. Mr. Horvitt, are you on the phone?
I am, Rick. I'm pleased to be with you tonight.
I am, too. This is some book. I got to tell you, its title is Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and a Life of Public Service. You know, I know that I've heard people have said, well, it's like a Tuesdays with Maury kind of thing. It is so much more than that. That's a sort of a slightly admirable book, Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom. But this is so much more. When you decided, can I call you Sandy or do you prefer Sanford?
Sandy is great.
Sandy. Yeah, I thought I got that sense from reading about your relationship with... I knew Mr. Mikva pretty well. My father knew him incredibly well. You two first met in about 1974, but when you decided to do this book, it was... I have to think that you were working out some things in your own life, too, were you?
Well, I reached the point, even though I was a generation younger than Ab Mikva, where I was starting to reflect on what I had learned in politics, and we had gotten into a period that was a pretty tough, not very inspiring time, even when we had an otherwise inspiring president, Barack Obama, in the White House.
Yeah.
And I knew that Ab was not in great health. And so one day I came to Chicago, where I used to live, And I went to see him on North Lakeshore Drive in his retirement apartment with his wife, Zoe, who just recently passed away just several weeks ago at 90 years old. And I said to Ab, you know, what do you think about getting together maybe once a month and talking about your thoughts on the country now and then and getting older and facing perhaps the end at some point, kind of the waterfront.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what he was going to say, and his first words...
Absolutely is what he
absolutely
said.
Absolutely, you're exactly right. It was one word. It wasn't even more than one word.
Well, you write in here that you did go up to the retirement high-rise on North Lakeshore Drive. Which one was it? Was it the Admiral or...
Well, when I started, it was the Hallmark.
Around
3,000, North Lake Shore, just a little south of Belmont.
It's interesting here, Sandy. You write, after an hour or so of chit-chat, I finally forced myself to ask him whether he might be interested in having a series of conversations. Why did you feel that way? I suppose you didn't want to imply, like, hey, Ab, it's getting late in your life, but why did you have to force yourself, do you think?
Well, because I think I was a little concerned about him saying no, and I would have felt badly about it.
Yeah.
I would have, you know, maybe taken it personally that there was some rejection. It was silly on my part, really. And as soon as he said, absolutely, I'd love to do it, it all, of course, made perfect sense, and that was the enthusiastic, optimistic, very generous Ab Mikva that I had gotten to know beginning, as you said, Rick, in 1974.
Yeah, I met Admiral Mikva. I'm going to, Sandy, as we go through this, because you're going to be on for 45 minutes, read, you know, sentences here and there, and then we can just expand on that. Because I remember this. I met Abner Mikva in the winter of 1974. He was gearing up for another congressional race in a Republican-leaning district in the North Shore suburbs. He had been kind of gerrymandered out of the district where he had been elected successfully a number of times, yes?
Yes, that's exactly right. And he is really one of the very rare members of Congress, I think, in modern American history, who served in two very different political districts. When he represented the old second congressional district on the south side, from Hyde Park all the way to the east side and then down to the state line, that was a lopsidedly Democratic district.
No question.
But when he lost that district through reapportionment, it was carved up, and he was not one of the machine boys by any means.
No, he sure.
And no one was going to do him.
You can say that again. You could actually pepper this conversation with that line. No, he was not one of the machine boys.
Right.
But I have a vague memory of that. I was in my early 20s then, and he was a great friend of my dad's, and so I paid, more attention than I would normally to politics in my early 20s. But I was kind of flabbergasted that he won that race. Were you too? You were intimately involved in that.
Yes, so he went up to the North Shore. It was a newly created district. It was then called the 10th Congressional District. And the first time he tried in 1972,
right,
which was a bad year for Democrats, George McGovern, the Democratic presidential candidate, lost in a landslide to Richard Nixon.
Yes.
And Ab Mikva ran a pretty close race, but he lost. And I was not involved in that race.
Right.
But 2 years later, he was going to give it one more try. And that is the Watergate year. It turned out to be a very good year for Democrats nationally. And that was the first of three consecutive victories that Ab Mikva had, each of them by less than one percentage point.
God, good Lord. You write in the book, and one of the things I really, really liked about this book, Sandy Horwitt, is it is not simply a sort of transcription of conversations you had. There is incredible context in here, and it is also a virtual kind of mini biography of you, too, which I really, really enjoyed. You write here, for instance, I began volunteering his campaign a few hours a week, and by the summer it was my full-time job. At the time you were teaching at what we always conventionally call Circle Campus, which was Circle then, but you wanted to be doing something political. Why did you want to be doing something political, Sandy?
Because that's really more who I was, and I really was not an academic. And a couple of professors at Northwestern, where I did both my undergraduate and graduate work, really influenced me. I thought the world of them, and I followed in their academic footsteps. But that really wasn't me. And when I was out for 1 year out of Chicago during that stretch of being a student, I went to San Francisco State College. And there, somewhat ironically, because he's such a great Chicagoan, is where I finally got to know who Saul Alinsky was.
Yeah, I want to talk. You do a wonderful job. Alinsky was another great friend of my father's and a great hero of mine. You do a remarkable job later in the book with him. One of the we got to take a break, but you're going to be on for another half hour. Sanford is the book jacket spelling. Sanford Horwitt, Horwitt, Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and a Life of Public Service. They are comprised of, but have a lot more than just monthly conversations that Sandy and Ab had over the last 3 years of his remarkable life. I was, when we come back after a short commercial break, Sandy, I want to talk about his early life, about which, frankly, I knew very little. And I think you're very honest and open about the relationships that both you and he had with your respective fathers. And if we could talk about that, I'll give you 2 minutes. I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes to prepare for that, okay?
Very good.
Wonderful, Sandy. We'll be right back. Thank you. Abner Mikva was a congressman, a federal judge, a White House counsel to Bill Clinton, a mentor, a serious mentor to Barack Obama. He was also a great friend of Sandy Horwitt Sanford on the book jacket, with whom he worked closely for many, many years, and who has done his mentor terribly proud with a book titled Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and a Life of Public Service, which is based not wholly on 3 years of monthly conversations they had before Mikva died. You do not consider this, Sandy, before we get into Ab's early life, you do not consider this a biography, and I will argue with you that any future biography of Abner Mikva will have to rely on this book profoundly.
Well, thank you for that compliment, Rick. I think of it more as a kind of a joint memoir.
Yeah.
And yeah. Much more about Ab Mikva. I'm the junior person in these conversations. But I think our lives did have some similarities. You mentioned before the break.
Sure.
That we talked about our fathers. For Mikva, growing up in Milwaukee, mainly during the Depression years, he came from a really very tough home situation, about as tough as one could imagine.
Yeah.
His father lost his job at the very beginning of the Depression, around 1929, 1930. So for a good part of the 1930s, they had no income. They were on relief, as the word was used then. We used welfare
sure.
later, but it was called relief in Milwaukee during that period. Young Ab Mikva felt humiliated that in his circle of friends who were 8, 10, 12 years old, that he thought he was the only one who was on relief and didn't have anything.
Yeah.
In addition to that, his parents had a terrible marriage. Ab thinks it was an arranged marriage in the old country, even though they actually got married when they came to the States from Ukraine. And his father hit his mother periodically, and it was still painful for Ab to even talk about it 75 years later when we got together.
Well, you are so You are so frank about so much in this chapter. I think it's the second chapter in the book. And let me just look and make sure. No, it's first chapter, From Rags to Respect, where you write, Ab and I both did well academically, even though our family lives were not child-rearing models by today's standards. As a kid, I don't remember my parents ever reading a story to me. In writing this book, you couldn't have, I don't think, Sandy, and please tell me if I'm wrong, at the beginning of this process of interviewing Mr. Mikva, and maybe your intention was not even to do a book. Maybe it was just to simply have these conversations transcribed. When did you decide, and it's a very emotional decision, to become part of the story?
Well, I thought of that pretty early, Rick. Mm-hmm. And as a writer yourself, and a great writer, you'll appreciate this. I started right from the beginning after Ab said, absolutely, I'd love to get together every month or so and talk about the country then and now and so forth. And I tried to figure out almost instantly how this could work if it turned out to be a book.
Yeah.
And I wasn't positive, probably for the first year,
sure,
that this really could work as a book, and it could work as a conversation between the two of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to. I mean, describe your relationship with, you were a speechwriter, you did a variety of things. Give me the quick resume before we go on to arguably the most famous line in the history of Chicago politics, of which Mikva was part. So when you worked for him, how long did you work for him, and what did you do for him?
I worked for him for 5 years when he won in 1974 and went back to Washington from this northern suburban district. I was his speechwriter and worked on some legislative projects. The one in particular that I was the key legislative aide for was his work on gun control. He was the leader in Congress, both in the House and the Senate, for trying to do something about handgun violence in this country. This is now back in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And I worked with him for the 5 years until the day he was confirmed by the U.S. Senate and became a federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit.
Mm. He also, and the way you related, and I think, you know, half the people who blurb the book say the line, too, that he wanted in 1948, he wanted to work in the campaigns of Adlai Stevenson and Paul Douglas, and he was walking around Hyde Park, and he went in the 8th Ward regular Democratic organization storefront on Cottage Grove. And what happened in there, Sandy?
Well, just to give a touch of a background, you know, he grew up in Milwaukee,
right,
which was famous at the time for clean, good government. You know, practically the antithesis of what Chicago was known for.
And still known for, yeah.
And still known for. Well, the big political machine was a little different then.
Sure, you're right.
But corruption, you had to know somebody to get anything done. And Mikva was told, you know, when you go to Chicago and go to law school, you can forget about getting involved in politics because it's a whole different thing. But now he's at the University of Chicago Law School, 1948. He's a 22-year-old kid, recently married. And he sees that Paul Douglas is running for the U.S. Senate and Adlai Stevenson is running for governor, and these are two really intellectual Democrats running, just the more Wisconsin kind of guys.
Sure, absolutely.
Chicago guys.
Yeah.
And so he's walking home from law school one night, and he sees the posters of Douglas and Stevenson in this little storefront of the 8th Ward regular Democratic organization on, as you said, around 79th and Cottage Grove. And so he goes in, and on the front there was the name of the ward committeeman, Timothy O'Sullivan.
Which is almost too perfect a name for a ward committeeman. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the secretary shows them into Sullivan's office, and Mikva says, "Hi, I'm Abner Mikva, and I'd like to volunteer in the Douglas and Stevenson campaigns." And O'Sullivan takes a big fat cigar out of his mouth and says, "We ain't got no jobs." And Mikva says, "Well, I don't want a job. I just want to volunteer in the campaigns." And O'Sullivan says, "Who sent you?" And Mikva says, "Nobody sent me." And O'Sullivan said, "We don't want nobody, nobody sent." And that was the beginning and end of the discussion with Ward Committeeman O'Sullivan. And that has become a kind of legendary Chicago story. There's actually a book written by Professor Rakoff.
Milt Rakoff, sure, sure.
You know, Milt Rakoff called, "We don't want nobody, nobody sent."
Oh, they're just too much. There are so many political figures moving in and out of this book. You know, you detail, which another portion of the book that fascinated me was his Mr. Mikva's encounter with the Film Review Board, which very few people in Chicago even know what that was. Could you detail that for a bit?
Yes.
I found that part fascinating.
Even as late as the 1950s and into the 60s, Chicago had a film review board. Now, other cities had a similar kind of operation to pass judgment on whether a movie could be shown at a theater in their city. Well, what made Chicago's really very distinctive was that all the members of the film review board were women.
Were these old women who had been like the wives of dead cops and stuff, right?
Yeah, they were widows and wives of either police or politicians in the city.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable. We got to take another break. I am on the phone with Sanford, the on the book jacket, Sanford Horwitt, Horwitt, the author of Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and a Life of Public Service. It is for those of you who lament the current state of American politics and indeed local politics, since only, you know, a paltry number of you came out to vote in the last election here. This book will give you hope, because this was a giant. I don't know if people like Sandy in 30 seconds, people like Abner Mikva come around once in a generation, and I just hesitate to think that we're likely to see his like again.
Well, I think that there is a legacy, and the legacy, I think, can inspire the next democracy's next generation. The book is dedicated to democracy's next generation.
Good. We're going to come back after the news, and I want to talk about your baseball scholarship at Northwestern, because this book is a lot about you, too. And you, I don't know you. We have a wonderful mutual friend in Jim Epstein, but you're a fascinating guy, too. So we will carry on in that fashion. Welcome back. Sandy Horwitt, that's Horwitt, the author of Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and a Life of Public Service, has kindly agreed to stay on for the rest of this hour, because I just find this book, and I find you, Sandy, pretty fascinating. Near the end, we were talking about the end of last half hour, we were talking about how this book may help inspire people who are toying with politics, and I find many of not just my contemporaries but younger people just turned off by politics. You write near the end of the book, "I was inspired by Ab Mikva when we met more than four decades ago, and I feel newly inspired by our conversations over the last 3 years of his life. Even at 90 years old and with all those pills he had to take, his determination to make a difference, to fight for a more just society and country, was never compromised." That is my hope, that young people reading this book, you know, who may never, you know, it makes me kind of sad, but I think given this new Twitter age and the way people, the sad numbers of voters who vote in elections, there may be people who have never heard of Abner Mikva, and I think that's a tragedy, don't you?
Yes, I do, because what he represents is, I think, the best of our democratic tradition. And there is this organization, which I should mention, this is a good place to do it.
Sure.
That Ab and his wife Zoe helped to create, along with about half a dozen of us, his former congressional staffers. It's called the Mikveh Challenge.
Of course it is. I know it well, but please.
And, well, in 2014, President Obama awarded Ab the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And when he received it, as President Obama was standing behind Ab and draping the medal over his chest, the announcer off stage started listing all of his accomplishments. He served in the three branches of the federal government. He was chief judge of the appeals court,
right,
and so forth. But the last line was, and he has inspired the next generation to be engaged in as part of their civic duty.
Yeah.
And Ab is really was most proud of that generally, but more specifically of the Mikveh Challenge. I was the founding president of the Mikveh Challenge. Mm-hmm. I've been on the board for a number of years. This spring in Chicago on April 4th, I will be back in Chicago because we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Mikveh Challenge.
Wow.
And Rick, you know, not many people in Chicago know this, but with each local election, whether it's an alt for the mayoral primary, mm-hmm, like the recent one, or a presidential year, there are now literally thousands of high school students,
yep,
that are trained by the Mikveh Challenge,
yep,
to work on election day at the polls. And this is not work about donuts and coffee.
Right.
This is the heavy lifting of making sure that the election goes off smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just one of a dozen programs that the Mikveh Challenge has developed over the years to really engage young people in their formative years in the political and civic process. And Ab was rightfully proud. He said this was one of the last things we talked about. We talked about it periodically over the 3 years of our conversations, but we got to it in a more focused way toward the end of our conversations. And he said that it was the best thing that he and his wife, Zoe, had done with their lives, which is quite a statement given everything,
wow,
that he accomplished.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. I've known a lot of Mikveh Challenge. I've always referred to them as Mikveh Challenge kids. Many of them are no longer kids, but it's a remarkable, remarkable organization. You do a lovely job in the book, too, Sandy, of detailing the Chapter 6, when the Nazis came marching in. I find that even people of a certain age, that being my age, they forgot all about this thing. You know, Studs Terkel used to tell me that we suffer from a collective Alzheimer's, and all we're thinking about is things in the future, and that it is dangerous to forget. To forget the past. Can you talk a little about the famous, infamous Nazis' desire to come to Skokie?
Yes, this happened in 1977 mainly, mm-hmm, and it involved a small band of Nazis in Chicago,
yeah,
who were trying to get attention, and they picked Skokie partly or mainly. Because at the time Skokie not only had a significant Jewish population, it was a suburb then of about 70,000 people,
yeah,
and maybe a third were Jewish, but in addition to that, Skokie had the highest number of Holocaust survivors per capita of any town or city in the country.
Yep.
And so this was an attempt to be, provocative, mean-spirited, however you want to describe it. And at first, the village of Skokie was going to do what other jurisdictions around the country did when Nazis wanted to cause trouble by demonstrating. And they decided that they would allow them to do a demonstration for a half hour, but they would basically try to ignore them and not give them any reason to get press coverage. Well, that really was not very satisfying for many of the Holocaust survivors who had such vivid memories.
See, one of the, Sandy, if I can interrupt you for a second, what I remember distinctly about it, and I think that indeed something good may have come of all that, in that many of the Holocaust survivors did not talk about, they were not having, you know, cake and coffee and talking about the Holocaust. That this, what this did, in a sense, was make these Holocaust survivors a more activist and forthcoming group, eventually, I think, leading to the founding of the Illinois Holocaust Museum.
Yes. So that's exactly right. Initially, though, while this was starting to unfold in 1977, it was the pain that so many of the survivors said that they were re-experiencing. And so Skokie then passed three ordinances to try to keep the Nazis from marching. They made a U-turn on their strategy. And one of the ordinances, for example, was to prohibit any group from wearing military-style uniforms that included a swastika. Well, as much as everybody, most well-intentioned people, despise what the swastika stands for, in this country we do have a First Amendment that protects you know, even things that we don't like to hear, and even symbols like a swastika. So pretty much from the beginning, when Skokie passed these ordinances, I knew a lot about the First Amendment from my undergraduate work at Northwestern, and Ab was well known as a civil liberties attorney.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
Just parenthetically, Rick, I was listening to your earlier segment tonight about Mr. Kelly's coming back, which I think is just wonderful.
Yeah, no kidding.
And one of the performers at Mr. Kelly's in the late 50s and early 60s was someone that Ab represented when he wrote for Playboy magazine, and that's Lenny Bruce.
Sure.
And so Ab was very familiar, and Lenny Bruce, you know, pushed the envelope when it came to the choice of language, and so Ab was very familiar with the First Amendment issues when this situation in Skokie arose, while he represented Skokie as a congressman.
Yeah. You are, I will tell you too, Sandy Horwitt, you are a very talented writer, because the narrative drive of this book is really something. When I would read anything that Jim Epstein told me to read, and so I did, but when I began at the narrative drive here, there are chapters that are just, that just totally stand out. I'm not even going to talk to you about your baseball career at Northwestern, because I want to, after this commercial break. There's another line in here that just is one of my bugaboos, too. Well, we end this segment. You write that a big part of the problem, as Abner Mikva saw it, is the soaring cost of political campaigns. That could not be a bigger issue for me on any single level. We're going to take a short break and come back, and I want to talk to you about Saul Alinsky, about Barack Obama, and a little bit more about you. Are you doing any book signings in Chicago?
I think I will be. I don't have a date to give you.
Let me know, because
57th Street
Books, of course,
would like to have me come.
I bet they would. And there are other places, too. It's really, in so many ways, Sandy, just a remarkable book. It is inspiring. And I think any, you know, Mikva Challenge alum will go crazy for this thing. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and I will close off this edition of After Hours. Welcome back. I have about six more minutes with Sandy Horwitt, the author of Conversations with Abner Mikva, Final Reflections on Chicago Politics, Democracy's Future, and A Life of Public Service. It is based on 3 months. It's based on a deep, deep friendship between Sandy and Ab Mikva, but also on monthly conversations they had over the last 3 years of Mr. Mikva's life. And something that will haunt me forever, Sandy, is I did not remember or did not know that Abner Mikva died on the 4th of July, because I've ever been haunted by the fact that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams both died on the 4th of July, too. It just... Oh, I don't know. I'm susceptible to things like that, I suppose. I suppose.
Yes, and so am I. And yeah. I think if it's ever a fitting time to die, dying on the 4th of July was the time to do it.
Yeah, and for an American, a real American hero, you had written, and I'm going to get this book, I'll order it tomorrow, a book about a very interesting chapter here that begins with you talking about, it's the Clinton White House and Hillary's liberalism. And in the midst of talking about things like Paula Jones, the name Saul Alinsky comes up here because Abner Mikva told you that Hillary was a huge fan of Saul Alinsky. You write about Saul Alinsky. He was an authentic American original and an unusual mix of intellectual and street cred, a brilliant graduate student at the famed sociology department at the University of Chicago, a well-read master of the Federalist Papers and the great books, an acquaintance of Chicago mobsters. My father knew him well and thought him a towering figure. Certainly you do, too.
Well, I got to know Alinsky as your father did, and I still think of him as a heroic figure.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just so ironic that Alinsky, long after he died in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
But his legacy lived on, so that the reason Barack Obama came to Chicago initially was to become an Alinsky kind of community organizer on the South Side.
Yep.
And Hillary Clinton and I have at least one thing in common. While I was sitting in Evanston writing my PhD dissertation about Saul Alinsky's methods of social change, young Hillary Rodham from Park Ridge was sitting in Wellesley, Massachusetts, as a senior in college, writing her senior honors thesis on the exact same topic.
That is a small world. That's sort of spooky to me, frankly. That's kind of spooky to me. You and Mikva met former President Obama at the same time, roughly, did you not?
Yes, I met young Barack Obama, who had just served maybe his first year or so in the state's Illinois State Senate, at a meeting we had arranged by my old friend who had ran AFSCME in Illinois at the time, Henry Bear, in Henry's office, because he thought Barack and I had something in common, that we both wanted to start a nonprofit organization that would advocate for various progressive issues. And so we spent a couple of hours at first meeting in Henry's office, and he was a very affable guy. I must say I did not see the future president of the United States, but that was probably my fault and no one else's.
Talk about, and as we end this, and again, ladies and gentlemen, we have just touched on the surface of the riches that are contained in Conversations with Abner Mikva. It's a remarkable document based on conversations between two friends at the end of the life of one of those. The introduction, the first line of the introduction of the book reads: Abner Mikva saw death coming, but not Donald Trump. Mikva's influence on, and we're talking about people inspiring youngsters today. He had, I think, a profound influence on Obama, didn't he?
I think so. Ab had served for 10 years in the state legislature.
Yep.
When they finally got to meet each other, and I say finally because Mikva heard about Obama as this star student at Harvard Law School when Mikva was the chief judge on the U.S. Appeals Court in Washington. But he was told that Obama didn't want a clerk for him. It was nothing personal, but he wanted to go back to Chicago right after law school. He didn't want a clerk for anybody, and he wanted to get involved in politics.
Mm.
And so Ab and Barack did not meet each other until Ab Ab Mikva and his wife Zoe returned to Chicago in 1998.
Yeah.
And then they became very close friends. They lived near each other in Hyde Park.
Right.
They were both teaching law at the University of Chicago Law School, Obama constitutional law, Mikva the legislative process. And they had a lot of sessions together, including at the wonderful Veloy's cafeteria,
sure,
on 53rd, where,
yep,
Ab and I recreated some of those times he had with Barack.
Yeah. It just is a remarkable book. I mean, there's been a considerable amount of praise from it, including a preface forward by Senator Dick Durbin. It just, you must be proud, Sandy. I mean, it's a sort of, you know, I've written a lot of obituaries for the Tribune over the years, and in a sense for me they are like goodbye letters to old friends, where you try to capture the essence of those people. But I think you've done that in this, and I feel a sense of pride when I'm able to pull that off, but this is vastly different, and I think you, I'll tell you, you should be proud.
Well, Rick, thank you very much. It's coming from you. It's a high, high compliment. And I hope people will have a similar reaction when they read it. And as I said, the book is dedicated to democracy's next generation.
Yeah.
And I really hope it does find an audience among younger Chicagoans and younger Americans anywhere.
Yeah, we've got a big election coming up in 3 weeks from Tuesday for the new mayor of the city of Chicago. I'm sure you've been watching that with some interest. Sandy, when you come in for any kind of book event, please let me know and come back on the air. It was a fascinating book, and it's increasingly revelatory to talk to you about it. So congratulations. Jim Epstein has good friends. I've only met a few of them, but I'm glad he introduced us. I really am.
Thank you very much.
My
Rick.
Pleasure.
I really hope to meet you.
I hope to meet you face to face one day. Thank you. It's a great, great book. The title again, Conversations with Abner Mikva. Go buy it, read it, and take it to heart and head. We'll get some commercials in, and then I will say goodnight. Be careful out there this week. It is St. Patrick's Day frenzy, so green beer, whatever you do, just be careful. Do not jump in the river next Saturday. I'll see you next Sunday.